Thank you for the kind invitation, and it's a pleasure for me to be at the Field Institute and to talk about some work that I have been doing with co-authors for, I think, 12, at least 12 or more years. How did it come to this kind of asking for a more general approach than we are typically using that has been growing and still growing, the so-called risk-neutral, the classical approach? I was in around 91, I came to Australia, and at that time I did this numerical work, and some of you know my book with Peter Klöden, and we priced and hedged at that time stochastic volatility models, barrier options and things like that. I gave a course in Sydney for the so-called Q group, these are the quants, and talked about these things, and from that collaboration with, at that time, one of the leading investment banks, Bankers Trust, started, and it was very successful. I had a Center for Financial Mathematics at the Institute of Advanced Studies at the Australian National University. We worked for several years. They funded very nicely our research, but in around 94 or 95, when it was pretty much clear what we were doing and what they wanted, I asked the most senior person in Bankers Trust New York, what would you do if I would ask you to price for me a guarantee on a pension which is going at maybe 30 years, not just 2 or 3 years. These are the derivatives which, in principle, they wanted to price, and we did it under some really quite different models. Heston was more or less the simplest one. And what he answered was, of course, the obvious answer. He said he would just go ahead with what they have been doing all the time. And he said, look, when I do it and simulate it myself with all the tools we have, what comes up is that when I do it with neutral this pricing, I feel it's too expensive in principle. There must be a cheaper way of achieving this goal, this payoff. I know that the index, the equity index, will be high up and saying at the money today, priced on this index. I can simulate it from just and look at graphs and the distribution, the real world distribution, and would feel it's really more or less overpriced, this kind of put what I may ask for. We discussed, and we never finished this discussion, but it was in my mind that something is wrong. Something is wrong with what more or less investment banking has been doing. And from that time onward, I didn't continue much the work with industry. I just was focusing on clarifying this kind of question. So what happens with long-dated contract, how we price it correctly and hedge it perfectly, and what is the economically correct price? And out of this, then this idea on this benchmark approach came up, and there is this book with David Hees, which Matthias already mentioned, and there's further work, and I have been working also very much with industry, also the insurance industry, and tomorrow in the afternoon there's another talk where I talk about these long-dated contracts. So this more or less belongs together. This morning's talk, tomorrow morning, and then the afternoon is more or less then towards industry. And this is part of the story. Many interesting things come out by looking in this wider modeling world, and this benchmark approach is giving you that. And it is actually simpler than the measure change that we involve when we do risk neutral pricing. And I like not to go in my presentations here too deep in technical details. It's not necessary. Yeah, it's much simpler, a number of things. And for instance, when I talk to the actuaries in the insurance firms, they love it in a way because things get really much faster to the point. So yeah, so this book, if you like to read more, you find it. And also go to my webpage. There's far more. There are works with Kostas Kardaras, who was here, as well as Damir Filipovic, and quite a number of other colleagues now go in these directions with arguments. And it's pretty easy. And you will see after that introduction where you can benefit. So this is a little bit the outline. As you will see, there will be a little bit of repetition later. And we will see whether we go into all of the details there. It's more material than I typically can accommodate in these 2 days. And I ask you for questions whenever you have questions. And it will guide me so that we don't waste time on things which are obvious, but maybe go too fast on other things. So let me come also from a side in my introduction here, which is more economically motivated, which is coming more from classical economic thinking. So most of you might have heard about the law of one price. So very obvious and seemingly very clear statement. So if you can hedge a claim, and maybe you have several ways of hedging it, in any case, you would expect there's just one price for it, that in some price process which would finally replicate this, say, replicable claim. But in reality, it's not like that. I will give you later examples. So this very classical law of one price, which you find in most economics and also in some finance courses, I think it needs to be reconsidered, and we talk about it. So under the benchmark approach, we will learn that even in a complete market, you may have several self-financing portfolios that replicate one and the same claim. This is possible, and this will be necessary to understand what realistic market modeling, particularly for long-dated securities, needs to do. So we will go beyond the law of one price. And here is the, I guess, start with a graph. Just at the beginning, all this is more a bit hand-waving. We will go later really into models and details and calculations. But here now to give you the idea why this also makes sense, even common sense. And this has very much to do with this kind of question what I asked this Bankers Trust the chief quant. So here in logarithmic scale, I show you a number of graphs. So what is what? This here would be the logarithm of what I would call a savings bond. Okay, assume the US deterministic interest rate would have been deterministic, as an interest rate would have been deterministic, and build a savings account, rollover short-term bond account, a savings account, and create it so that in 1920 it starts at some value, and this value at the end would be $1, but you see the log, so it's log of $1. So there will be a savings bond. Safely, you just roll over with the interest rate your investment and go up and achieve then without any local risk, more or less, your payoff of $1. Then I will show you there will be what I will call a fair zero coupon bond, which will hedge by investing in the S&P 500 and the savings account and achieve also $1 here in 2009 or whenever it is there. And this portfolio, this hedge portfolio self-financing, will start at a much lower price, it's a log scale here, and will more or less hedge then finally also in this $1. So this looks like arbitrage and so like that. Yeah? It is a weak form of arbitrage. Also, this is some kind of a free lunch with vanishing risk. But it exists. And it needs to exist to explain to us a number of things. What is going on here? What is going on is the following. This kind of hedge, which I will create with you later, as you can see, will follow for a long time the S&P 500 index, and later slide, according to a model which I will specify, but there are many different models possible, it will later then slide into this savings bond or savings account and achieve the same thing. Why is this possible? Here I show you you see it's more or less a savings account. This is the average slope of the savings account. At the beginning, you see the average slope of the log of the S&P 500. And we know there is an equity premium. An investor who invests in equity or the equity index will be rewarded in the long term by larger growth than what you get in fixed income. And it needs to be so, otherwise it would be would make no sense that investors really invest into the stock market. And historically, last century, it was about 5% that the equity market was growing faster than the fixed income of the savings accounts. And this is just a matter of fact. And whatever you want to model, in long term, this effect, this equity premium, which is physically there, which also logically, economically has to be there, this has to be taken into account, and it will be exploited, and has to be exploited, and you have to understand how this all functions. For instance, if another area of risk management is financial planning. So as a young person, you are told by a financial planner, look, you have a long time ahead. Take the wealth that you might save now and can put aside, take it and invest it in something which is growing. So say equity index or go into real estate and other things. Later, when you come closer to retirement, then it's wise to go out of more and more out of these fluctuating risky securities and slide into almost fixed income. And when you are retired, it's probably best just to stay almost only into fixed income. This is what common sense tells you, what financial planner tells you. If you would try to explain this with risk neutral pricing, you can't do that. It's just not working. It would give you another story. So what we will bring together with a benchmark approach, in principle, fund management in general, financial planning, as I just indicated, long-dated security pricing of any kind, and this will all happen, this pricing will all happen under the real-world probability. We will not do a meta change. So real options. Many other things that come in mind where common sense or economic thinking or actuarial thinking, sometimes having a problem to bring it all together, it will be here just under one roof in one setup. So this kind of situation we will explain and we'll see. For instance, I tell my students always in this story, there was, I had a grand-grandfather and a grand-grandmother, and in 1920, they were quite wealthy, and they had made a decision for all their maybe upcoming offsprings in a second or third generation, they put money aside on some accounts. And the grand-grandmother, she was really very careful and very cautious, and also she was looking after the girls in this family tree, more or less, in the future. And she said, yes, we bring it all to the Swiss bank, but I want to have it in a rollover savings account because I don't trust all these fancy things what you, the grandfather, has been doing, investing in the stock market and then having all these fluctuations. Okay, so she invested into the savings bond, and the look outcome of what she invested for the girls was somewhere here in the log spot. Whereas my grand-grandfather had this idea of equity premium and things like that, and secretly gave in an envelope to the banker, the Swiss banker in Zurich, the order to invest in such a way so that finally these things for the boys came up. And we will see the numbers later. This is just about 3% of what that is. It is 88 years, so it was quite a long time period, but these are substantial things. And if you have a government fund or your pension or something, it makes a major difference. And variable annuities, as they are in insurance, now really important and principle for all of us in some way, it makes a difference. And I think the industry will have to change, it will have to rethink on these issues. And what my aim is, pretty much these kind of ideas to explain to you that you have no doubts anymore. So what I did here, and you will see that later, the calculations, all this in detail. What I did here, I took the S&P 500 monthly data, accumulated all the dividends in, and I took this saving, other the short rate of the U.S., and created a savings account, and then did these calculations. And there is also, then you will later see, this has a hedge, which is pretty much perfect. I show you this later. Yeah? These are real data, yeah. But of course, you could simulate, and then you would see. So let's go into a financial market. Let's make it a bit more quantitative. So what we start with is a set of what I call primary security accounts. So these are, for instance, stocks with dividends reinvested, or savings accounts with interest reinvested, and there may be other primary security accounts. Then we will calculate and we'll have a strategy. A strategy will tell us, say with delta D, the number of units we invest at time T in the D stock, and the delta of zero will be the number of units invested in our domestic savings account, just to have also a savings account around. A portfolio is just a linear combination, that means number of units times a primary security account value. So that's a simple portfolio. And we will focus on self-financing portfolios because we want the law of conservation of value always be present in what we are doing. So that means self-financing here when you have stochastic integration, which I assume that we can do it for our objects here, will tell us changes in the value of the portfolio come only from changes in the value of the underlying and not from changes in the strategy. So self-financing in the simplest sense. And let's focus also in the next step on portfolios that are strictly positive. And here let them start at a positive value X. So it's a set of strictly positive portfolios that start in X. So the core of all these benchmark approach is more or less the existence of the numerair portfolio. So this is something which came up first in work by Long, and later it was developed further, the concepts. For instance, Dirk Becherer wrote a nice paper. I've done some work, and there's further work, which you can find a very general consideration in a semi-martingale setting. So what is a numerair portfolio? Numerair portfolio, without looking at the definition, is in some sense the best performing portfolio, strictly positive portfolio that you can form in your investment universe. It's just a question how you mathematically define it the most conveniently. And the best, easiest definition is the following. If you take any non-negative portfolio in your investment universe, express it in units of what your candidate numerair portfolio is, then these, I call it benchmarked non-negative portfolios, should all form super martingales. So that's pretty much in one sentence. Okay, you can express it in many ways. One way which is totally equivalent to what I said is look at returns. Look at your non-negative portfolio expressed in units of what we will call the numerair portfolio. Look at it at some later time, divided this, let me call it benchmark value, earlier time, minus one. That means here's a return, and take the expected return at this earlier time. So more or less expected returns of benchmarked non-negative securities should be less or equal to zero for all non-negative benchmark portfolios. Then what you have found, this S delta star, this is the numerair portfolio. It's unique. Only one such portfolio can exist. And in principle, what you see here in the long term, because of this equality sign in the long term, such benchmark non-negative portfolios have no trend, or somehow in the long term downward trending, if you want to have a loosely sort of impression of what is written here. Of course, locally there may be no trend, because these benchmark objects can be local martingales also, but we talk about this in detail. So in the general, this Numeraire portfolio is so good that when used as Numeraire, forces any non-negative portfolio in principle downward, or maybe having no trend. That's roughly saying it, but precisely what you see here is more or less the super martingale property of benchmarked non-negative portfolios. And there are many other expressions and manifestations, mathematical manifestations, which show you that really in various ways is that a star is best performing, and I will come to that later. So the main assumption of this benchmark approach is just a very simple statement. It's the following: in our investment universe, or what we want to model, there exists a Numeraire portfolio. So there exists such a best performing portfolio that the expected benchmark returns are less or equal to zero. So this super martingale property, which I will mention in the next. Yes, come. Okay. We come to this in more detail, but I prefer always to try to answer immediately as much as I can. So first, if you have the same investment universe and the same information set, and you write down your mathematical description, and you find the same estimates of whatever parameters and so on you want, yes, this will be exactly the same object. But this is a mathematical statement, because the Numeraire portfolio is unique. In practice, you might have slightly different estimators than you have, and there may be other features of it. You might get slightly different results if you would do it purely mathematically, by just writing down your model and calculate it. We will come later to, the word came up in your statement, robust, and yes, I can say it will be very robust, what we are talking about, and I come later to it. There will be a diversification theorem, which I will explain, which says the following. Any diversified portfolio, which has to be mathematically specified, which I give later, but pretty much small fractions in anything of the constituents of your market, then your portfolio, your diversified portfolio, and also your diversified portfolios, if we go to infinity with the number of constituents in this market, they will converge to the same thing. Even that you have in sum double the fraction, and you may leave even few of them out. It will converge to the same object, and this object is the Numeraire portfolio. Yes. Yes, yeah, okay. So, yes, it's very robust. That means, yes, if you have nothing else and just concentrate on the U.S. market, the S&P 500 is already a good proxy for the Numeraire portfolio because of this diversification theorem, but there will be better ones. And it's very interesting to have these better ones then also in focus, and there's some work going on. Here is a little bit the idea of what you just asked. What I do here is the following. I have formed in the world market, first, a market capitalization weighted index, this MCI, market capitalization weighted index. So this is pretty much the MSCI world index. If you would plot it, it would just be almost identical on this curve. Then, here, this is the calculation where I form such a diversified portfolio. What I do is I take the simplest diversified portfolio that I can form, and it is built on data which are available to you all. I went to DataStream. DataStream is having industry subsector world indices. So they take an industry sector, say banking, and build this for the entire world. So US banks, European banks, Indian banks, and whatever, everything is in that. So they get more or less an accumulation index for banking and for mining and so on. So they have about 104 such world indices, and if you go to DataStream, you find these. So you have 104 securities. What I do with these securities, I build a very diversified portfolio by just taking, building an equal value weighted index, an equally weighted index. So the same fractions each day. So it's daily data. Yeah? And then, of course, I have to recalculate each day and get another portfolio. It's a very diversified portfolio. And you see, this is its performance here. But much better even than the market capitalization weighted index. And the explanation is, we are closer with this to the numerator portfolio than we were with the market capitalization weighted index. And by the way, some of you may be interested, what is this here? There's a work by Yanis Karatsas and Bob Fernholz. And Bob Fernholz is running in Princeton a fund, a substantial fund, where, and his, in his research work, also his book he has in the Application of Mathematics, Modern Portfolio Theory also, or Stochastic Portfolio Theory, he's talking about strategies which are able to outperform the market capitalization weighted indices. And so he talks about also diversification or diversified, he's not talking diversified portfolio, but some diversifying strategy. So what it actually is doing, when you look at the related strategy, he takes more or less a fraction from the market capitalization weighted index and distorts these. It's more or less taking a power, I think a square root or so of this. And what is happening is he makes the large fraction smaller and the small fraction is larger by this operation. So in this way, he makes this portfolio, what he formed, more diversified than the market capitalization weighted index. But not as diversified as I just simply go ahead when I make it bluntly equal value weighting. And he gets a better performance. And this is why his fund is also very successful in a way. But you can do better. Although you can have a chance to come closer to the numerator portfolio if the numerator portfolio was not the market capitalization weighted index. And the classical economic theory, so capital asset pricing and others, suggest in some form that the market capitalization weighted index is something which is on, say, the efficient frontier. So it's a mixture of the best performing portfolio in some sense and savings account. And what we learn here, what one can really see when one is looking at some of our papers here with Chuck Lee, who wrote this kind of paper here with his graphs, that the market capitalization weighted index is not close to the numerator portfolio. It's reasonably close. If you have nothing else, it's a good start. But there are objects in our investment universe that are coming closer to the numerator portfolio, that are better performing, in particular in the long run. And yes, I just mentioned here now that these diversification strategies that Bob Fernholz uses give you some advantage, but there's eventually more. And this is just on plain data, and you can do it yourself. Yeah? And here's a paper. Yeah? Okay? Also, WSI is pretty much the same. Yeah? Also, things are also EWI, not the WSI is de facto the same as just for the graphs, because I took it out of a paper where we discussed it. So this is the equal value weighted index. And this is the following. You start with your capital, invest the same fraction of wealth in each of the world industries, 104. Then one day is going, next day some industries come up, others come down. Now you reallocate your wealth you have such that you gain again have equal value weighted capital in each. And so you go on. self-financing. But what you have a very diversified portfolio all the time with more or less equal value in each industry. And this is a one-over-end rule. Very naive, most naive diversification rule, yes. And by the way, there's a paper by Opmal talking about the one-over-end rule in Journal of Review of Financial Studies, I think. And he's showing if you want to go ahead, say, with a model and try to follow what fund management today is doing, it's more as a Markowitz portfolio optimization, where you have to estimate expected rate of returns and covariance matrices, and then theoretically you find the numerate portfolio there, the growth optimal portfolio. Then if you have, say, 50 or more securities in your investment universe, all statistics, what you are doing, is useless. The significance levels are so, the band are so wide, that what you are doing is better you do nothing. It's just really nonsense. This is what, in principle, is just the experiment, what fund management is doing with our pensions at the moment, is showing us. Still, the best funds are those who just match more or less the market portfolio. This is Vanguard, Fidelity, and others, and they outperform, in principle, any other actively managed funds. There are a few survivors, but if you start with 3,000 funds, then you have, after a while, still one or two or three that by active fund management get you something. Or maybe there are some insiders. Okay, that's another issue. But in general, you end up here if you just use market capitalization. Better is to diversify systematically, and you might have even a better performance. And I show you that here, and that is just a fact. Here are not transaction costs, but they are very, very low. And again, you find in that paper by Opmal that transaction costs are almost don't matter, because what are you doing? You keep it on that level. So if it is going a bit up, okay, you sell. If it's going down, you purchase a bit more. But this is not really such a transaction as Markowitz would ask you to do when these fractions from sample estimation chase you around from extreme to extreme. It's just eating up almost all the funds. That's just what we see. Yeah. So but this is one consequence of benchmark thinking, what I'm explaining here. But it's not the major thing what I want to explain. So let's go a bit more into detail. So a portfolio is then denoted by S delta, and S delta star is our numerate portfolio. And let's just simply benchmark a portfolio. That means this is here now with a head, our benchmark portfolio. And what in our thinking we are doing, we take the numerate portfolio as our currency or discount factor. So this is where we will place ourselves, no longer in the world where we have everything expressed in our domestic savings account, which in any case is different for the Canadian compared to the American, for instance. So, and then you have the super martingale property, just by the definition, it's just another way of writing what I wrote when I had the numerate portfolio written. For any non-negative portfolio, its benchmark value now is greater or equal than the expected future benchmark values. So this super martingale property is just more or less the statement that we have a numerate portfolio and we use it for benchmarking. So now I indicated already we have several easily accessible manifestations that the numerate portfolio is really best in a very useful sense. So here's one. Look at the long-term growth rates. So what is it? Take a portfolio at a later time over its initial value, take the logarithm and divide it by t. So it's more or less the slope in the log world, the slope of more or less your portfolio. And this slope is for each portfolio can be quite different, and you get a number if you go with t to infinity. It's just like a Lyapunov exponent if you come from dynamic thinking. So then there's a theorem. This long-term growth rate for the numerator portfolio is greater or equal than the long-term growth rate of any other non-negative portfolio. And look here, what is, there's no expectation, no convergence in probability or anything. This is plainly this one sample pass we experience in our life with the wealth that is evolving here in this investment universe. And if you go long enough, then almost surely the numerator portfolio will its value will outperform those of other values. Yeah? So going back to this graph which I had here, this is already indicating it. If this is a good proxy of the numerator portfolio, yes, it should outperform after a while those of other portfolios. And this is for one pass. Sorry, wrong direction. Good. So this one statement, so pass-wise, in the long term, it's best. So if you have 30 years ahead and, or more, that's something which makes a clear difference. Or if you are an insurance company or a pension fund who has open-end, who doesn't think on just that they close down in 5 or 10 years, then this is also something they have to look at. Yes? It's not needed. It's very interesting. The benchmark approach is not starting from representative agents or utility or so. I can always build the link, and I do that later. But this is not the core of the thinking. And here I feel it's a weakness of that economic theory went, from my point of view, too far in believing and trying to project it all into utility and other. Yes, we need to rank and we need to quantify these things. But it's a bit too much. Look, I don't need anything. I tell you, we want to model an investment universe, okay? And I say, in this investment universe, with one assumption, there's a best performing portfolio. And that's all. What could happen? What could go wrong? There may be a candidate for a best performing portfolio. And, yes, if the mathematical model is not nicely written or has some weaknesses, what could happen? The worst thing what could happen is this candidate for the best performing portfolio is exploding. But then the whole model is really not useful because I can't do much in it. So it's a more or less we are at the limit where we can model anything in principle. And if you ask them for semi-martingales, the super martingale property, this is just telling you we are in semi-martingales. So, and what you find, this best performing is optimal in many ways. So I told you with the expected return of the super martingale property. Here I show you that, and this is a few line proof more or less, that the long-term growth, almost surely, yeah, so the pass after a long time will outperform any other pass. And there are more. For instance, here, something which is really critical because you might think, yeah, but in the short term, what do I, is this then also good? Yes, it is. And of course, you have mathematically to be very careful and to see exactly what is it what you can state. I know I have the super martingale property, so I'm asking myself, when I did this here, I asked myself, what is it what the super martingale property will give me when I want to see something like systematic outperformance of one fund against another fund? Yes, and in this benchmark approach, yes, there are the possibilities that some systematic outperformance between one and the other happens. One example was my grandmother's savings bond, yeah, and my grandfather's fair zero coupon bond. So that's stated, yes. Yes. Yes, this is, yes, although you find it in my book, and there's almost nothing. You don't need anything. We are in this environment. What I need is only one thing, the super martingale property of the benchmark securities. And then what is happening is you use that, and we could go now to a copy of the book, and then I can show you. But it's more or less, okay, it's half a page or so. In the special case, you find such a proof in Karatsis and Shreve for some diffusion situation. Yes, yes, yes. We have some Duke type inequality estimates at some stages coming up with the right interpretation. But it's really plain, easy stochastic analysis. It's just nothing. And the proof for what I'm talking about here, it's even easier. It's two lines. So, and let's go for it. Let's take two funds that start at the same value at time zero. Okay? So, take for Matthäus is one, and maybe I have another one. And then let's both have agreed, from how we see, how it works, how it is set up, that one fund is greater or equal than the other fund at some later time, almost surely. Okay? So we know that. And then there's a statement that the other fund is strictly greater than this fund with some chance. So there is some strictly positive probability. Okay? Then I would say this fund here outperforms systematically the other fund. Okay, so there's a chance to be better after we know that they are greater or equal in this direction already. Yeah, of course, you could do this all the stopping times, this would be not a problem. So, this super martingale property again, but now in two lines, will give you the following result, that if you put at S delta tilde the numerator portfolio itself, then this last statement cannot come up. Which will mean the numerator portfolio cannot be systematically outperformed by any other strictly positive fund. But if you take, say, my grandmother's savings account and my grandfather's fair zero coupon bonds, starting, say, at the same value, yes, my grandfather's fair zero coupon bond will systematically outperform, clearly, my grandmother's savings account. Yeah. So the statement is, so we fix, but we could do the stopping times, we fix at a time, and then we talk about it, yes, 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 yes. Otherwise it would be not correct. Because what happens is, yes, Matthäus and I, we could have, sorry, maybe I take the numerator portfolio, but you can have anything. And of course, you can gamble as much as you want, and yes, you will have some outperformance trajectory-wise, but what we are talking about is you could not do that systematically in that sense. And we have seen already in the long term, even your gambling strategy will not perform in that form, is what I showed in the earlier statement. So here is this example, which when my grandmother with a savings account runs and my grandfather with his fair zero coupon bond, and yes, here I can really show you later on in the example exactly the situation. This is a definition, yes? Can you speak louder? I'm not sure whether I got your question completely right, but let me try to answer what I thought I understood. When we talk about this kind of definition, which I think you are still... So we come, although this is still a survey part, we come later far more into details also on these issues. Also almost everything what you mentioned will become clearer more, and let me go then into the detail. At the moment I'm still motivating, and I just mention here now some mathematical manifestations that the numerair portfolio is best. Let's stay for with this. So one was the long-term growth rate. Here, this kind of statement, where we fix the time, in between we don't look at it, and where we said we start at the initial value, here we know that one is greater or equal to the other, almost surely, and if the other is strictly greater than this reference one, with some strictly positive probability, then we call it, we say, this has systematically outperformed the other. By the way, independent of what I have been doing here in a paper in 2004, Fernas and Karatsis use the notion of relative arbitrage, which is pretty much what I'm describing here, and it has to do with the super martingale property, of course. Yes? No. In the next slide, you will see one more manifestation which makes it probably even clearer. But here is now a theorem which is just also a two-line proof. It comes from the super martingale property. The numerair portfolio cannot be outperformed systematically. So this is what I indicated already. If you have one of these reference portfolios here, the numerair portfolio, then the last statement cannot, you can prove that it cannot be true, and so we have no systematic outperformance of the numerair portfolio. But this is very interesting, in this benchmark framework you may have two portfolios where one is systematically outperforming the other. This is something which in classical this neutral and so theory you don't see. So let's go a bit further. Let's look at the portfolio ratio, the later value over an earlier value, take the logarithm of that ratio, and the condition expectation. So this is pretty much, it has something to do with growth or expected growth. Now, if I want to divide it by the length of the time interval, it would be really the slope, as we had it before, but let's not do it. You can work for a given h with this kind of expected growth. So expected logarithm. You see here expected log utility in principle covered. Here is a link to log to utility, but this is not essential. It's just a side remark. However, this expected growth you can show under this general assumption where I am. No assumption on E2 diffusions or whatsoever. Just this general super martingale property. You can do the following. You can say a portfolio, as delta underlined, is growth optimal if this expected growth for any portfolio, any non-negative portfolio, is less or equal than the expected growth of as delta underlined. So the definition. This links into log utility, yes. So we have a long literature starting from Kelly, who is the first who talked about it, and then we have a lot of other work. So then, without having any modeling assumption besides the super martingale property, I show in a proof the numerair portfolio is growth optimal. So, it may also answer a little bit a question which came up there. So the numerator portfolio, the benchmark, is also the gross optimal portfolio, which is very, very convenient because we have tools in a given mathematically described market model to calculate the gross optimal portfolio. So it means when you have a model, you know the gross optimal portfolio, this is the numerator portfolio. So that means it's not a way of saying about best performance having the maximum expected gross. That's the numerator portfolio. So yeah. It is. It is. And first we have the theorem, which I just mentioned. You can think of this log optimization that you find as this maximum unique. But think of the following. Let's go back to the definition of the numerator portfolio. You have, say, two candidates for the numerator portfolio. One, benchmarked by the other, has to be a super martingale. But the other, benchmarked by the former one, has to be also a super martingale. And then you find, by more or less by inequality, there can be only one. Yeah? Yeah. Never. Yes. Yes. There's an expectation of the log. Of course, in special cases, you can easily see it then, but in general, it's a bit more effort to prove it. So, the notion of arbitrage came up here. You mentioned at least a word in that. You have to be very careful now. We are going in a wider world than the fundamental theorem of asset pricing offers us. And very deliberate. That was more or less in this discussion what I had with this chief quant from Bankers Trust. Oh, he also argued, look, then you're out of all your fantastic mathematical theory, and he didn't want, so this was one of his strong arguments. He said, and what then? Then there's no mathematics anymore. I said, yes, there's not much, but it was just what I was building over these years. So what we are doing is we go into a wider world, and the notion of arbitrage has to be reconsidered. But those who grew up over the last 20, 25 years with development of mathematical finance know that there are many definitions of arbitrage. And Walter Schachermeier and Fadi Delban pointed them correctly out with a lot of work that if you want to have an equivalent risk-neutral probability measure to exist so that you can do this typical measure change which we are doing for pricing, so Harrison-Krebs, Harrison-Pliska, and so on, then this is more or less equivalent to the notion of having no free lunch with vanishing risk. And that's a very nice and beautiful statement in the semi-martingale markets we can form. And it's mathematically very convenient. Of course, it's quite hard analysis to prove that, but it's a nice and closing statement in a way. But this does not mean that this modeling world is suiting best or sufficient for certain tasks we want to do in risk management. And this was my point with the Bankers people, that they said, look, when I like to go out and pension 30 years, under this framework, I don't believe what is getting up, that is coming out, is reasonable. There's something wrong, and we have to rethink. So that's what I did. And what we are coming up now is with some slightly different notion of arbitrage. By the way, it's much closer to the earlier, ancient, very early grown notions of arbitrage that economists and others are thinking about. And this is the following. I call it strong arbitrage, just to make it a bit different to no free lunch and vanishing risk. And also asking myself, or ask yourself, what is it what we have to focus on when we like to discuss the notion of arbitrage? Arbitrage is something where some market participant can exploit an effect in the market where, in principle, he or she can make money out of nothing. Pretty much. But in which way? And this is a mathematically important question, what we do there. So, but if there's a market participant, say Matthäus, he has a portfolio of total wealth. And with this portfolio, he can try to chase arbitrage. Assume he's going for one specific form of arbitrage with his entire portfolio, okay? Which is one possible way. Then, what he needs to be able to do is he has to be able to chase this arbitrage with his total wealth. But his total wealth has always to be non-negative. Otherwise, he will be declared bankrupt and will be removed from the market. So that means when I chase arbitrage, when I like to exclude arbitrage in the model, I have to, in principle, to focus on non-negative portfolios, and these should be able pretty much to make something out of nothing with some strictly positive probability. This would be a very strong form of arbitrage. So when we say this limited liability that Matthäus or any such hedge fund or whatever it is, it will lead us to look at non-negative total wealth possessors. So we say a non-negative portfolio is a strong arbitrage if it starts at zero, is all the time non-negative, limited liability, and at some later time, it could be a stopping time, but here, if it's so, at some later time, there's some strictly positive probability and a strictly positive value. So this would be a strong form of arbitrage, really strong. Yeah? Very simple, economically very reasonable, and that's also where I think the cut has to be made, and the reference level is not some negative credit limit, because what your total tradable wealth is, this is what the banks or the other market participants who deal with you want to look at. And if it is zero, they may just be a bit cautious. And if it is negative, clearly negative, there's no deal. Yeah. Yes. Very correct. Very correct. So this will be not What you correctly point at is, I think, let me see what is coming up here, is the following statement. In this world, where we have everything benchmarked and look at non-negative portfolios that are super martingales, the following fact that a non-negative super martingale that starts at zero will never go out of zero, this is already, in one line, more or less, the proof for the fact that there is no strong arbitrage in this entire benchmark framework. And strong arbitrage arguments, don't make much sense. We cannot use it for pricing and so on. Yes, the whole arbitrage issue is of a secondary importance, where in the classical, historically grown understanding of financial modeling and mathematical finance, arbitrage is a very central part. And I say it is, of course, important, but in this way, as I am describing it here, this is not our major concern and automatically excluded what we call strong arbitrage. We can still discuss then different forms, weak forms, say, of arbitrage. So is there a systematic auto-performance, as I discussed before, or is there a free lunch is finishing risk? And I say, yeah, there may be some, and we can look at it. But all these weaker forms of arbitrage will ask us to have, to be exploitable, to have some collateral coming up, putting it aside, just to run with it in some form. But this is, then, if this is, say, your own activity to chase this arbitrage, you have to do it with your non-negative total wealth and not with some collateral. If you have collateral, then put it in your total wealth, and you can do other things with it. Yeah? So here, this is a bit of different thinking, and it may be strange to some of you, but it's just so simple, and let's in principle then go on and see what we can do without arbitrage as our core guiding principle. Yes, you are. No, this is just a theorem. You're completely right. Yeah, because of the super martingale property, we know that. Right? So there's no way of. It's also, this is the easy thing. It's a one line. You know immediately this kind of form is not there. But it's just rounding up and say strong arbitrage is not our issue. So yes, we may have free license suspension risk, and independent from what I did here, which I just I was guided by taking the super martingale property and saying what form of arbitrage is it, what if you like to talk about arbitrage which is automatically excluded, and this came up as strong arbitrage. And later I was pointed at the paper by Löwenstein and Willard, which is now in the bubble literature, also very common recited. They talk about free snacks and cheap thrills, and they, from economic reasoning, came, when I was looking very careful, pretty much to the same definition of what I call strong arbitrage as something which they say, this is what you need to be excluded, but not more. So we can have free lunches with financial risk, or free snacks, or cheap thrills, or these kinds of weak forms of arbitrage, and this will, the economic model will be fine. So completely independently, there's another way of thinking. Here I show you more or less what I took the fair zero coupon bond of my grandfather minus a savings account which started at the same value and show you then the portfolio. So it starts at zero, and then you see, because my grandfather's fair zero coupon bond was much better growing than my grandmother's savings account, yes, we see this beautiful increase of wealth. And it looks like really an arbitrage in a way, because out of zero something substantial came up, and look, over the 88 years, it's a very long, a very safe, this kind of thinking. But, and here it is, we need to look also in this area here to see what is happening there, in particular at the beginning, to come into something. So if I just enhance this part here, this is the first part of the trajectory, so from 1920 to the early years, then you see, and this is also what you said in principle, what is happening is there is some randomness, and this randomness will almost certainly bring us, at least for some period down with our total wealth into negative territory. So this is an arbitrage strategy, would need some collateral to make it working in some way. But if you have collateral, then you are back to another question. And so in this way we see there is this strategy is going with a portfolio that can become negative, so it's not a strong arbitrage what we have. But it is something which is in these ranges of free lunches, diminishing risk and other weak forms. So these things exist, and fine, no problem with that. If someone was exploited, fine. So yes, my grandfather could have done it compared to my grandmother, and fine, no problem. So to say it a little bit pointed, and it may upset some, but let me just say it. So the existence, or the requirement on the existence of an equivalent risk neutral probability measure, or a minimum martingale measure, or whatever you like in this setting, it's more a mathematical convenience. It's historically grown in our understanding how we model financial markets. And it was a very important part of the development to understand it all and to see which is an equivalent to something else. But economically, it's no real economic reason for assuming that there exists this artificial risk-neutral measure, and there may be even many, many, because as we know, in the incomplete market, it's a very complicated situation. This is not the core question. Even the question of arbitrage is not a core question if one is looking further. And comparing now, yes, if you insist on this risk-neutral probability measure to exist, what you are doing, you restrict your modeling universe, and as you will see later, your restriction is very much what I pointed out to this Bankers Trust person, where I said, in the long term, something is going wrong. You take away from me something which in my common sense tells me, and you cannot model that. And when you hedge it for me, I pay too much. So in principle, long-term trends, the equity premium in the market is physically existing, is in principle, under such an assumption, it's in principle ignored. We know that every model is just a limited reflection of reality. There's always a limit. So that means the modeling under risk-neutral measures is some very important way of reflecting what we see in the financial markets. And in the short term, as I will show you, it's fine. We can do a lot, and it's very successful after 2-3 years. No problem with that. It's sufficient. There's no need to go beyond that. But if you go into the long term, 25, 30 or more years, and maybe for certain other questions, then it is too narrow. And what the benchmark approach is doing, it's not taking anything away from the existing risk-neutral world. It's just a specific case in the benchmark framework that you have. And but you make it wider and you have all the tools to do whatever quantitatively and mathematically you want to do. Then there are historically grown pricing approaches. So for instance, you find in Cochrane's book very much, I think it's one of the most advanced in the economic literature, the stochastic discount factor approach. But when you read it carefully, you see, of course, there is the classical no-arbitrage thinking behind and the existence of an equivalent risk-neutral measure assumed to do that. But it is very close also to what the benchmark approach is doing, because the stochastic discount factor is very closely linked, or can be. You can just use the numerator portfolio to create that, and then you are in the same thinking what I'm doing. Or the deflator in Teradafi's book, very much the same, but again, assuming the existence of an equivalent risk-neutral measure. Pricing kernels are used, and we know, of course, that all these have to do with each other. State price density is another way of working with it, but in all cases, we use the classical no-arbitrage thinking. And Long, when he came in 1990, pointing out these numerator portfolios, the gross optimal portfolio, using it, and his observation was, if you use it, then your pricing measure is a real world probability. That was observation. But of course, he was even in the paper staying in a, more or less in a discrete setting, but otherwise assuming the existence of a risk-neutral measure. We can go further. There are then other pricing, for instance, utility indifference pricing. There are many ways, but take what Mark Davis did and suggested. In my book, you find that this is an equivalent to some of these approaches. And local risk minimization, I'm just working on it, in some way rewriting it. It all fits into it. But this up here, when you assume a risk-neutral measure or something equivalent, the fundamental theme of asset pricing, long-term trends, equity premium, is in principle ignored, and you get set yourself a limit. And as you will see, prices for, say, a long-term put or so, prices are typically higher than necessary if you go ahead in such a framework, assuming a risk-neutral measure. And this is economically really relevant, because it could be your pension or the life insurance you're purchasing from an insurance company. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Yes. Fine. No. No. So there's a paper by Konstantin and Karas and myself where we deal with these issues. Also, the paper by Karatsas and Karas already does a lot in this direction, where this NUBR condition, more or less what Kostas Karas was in principle also mentioning here, and it came up in some of the other talks last week. This is pretty much the sharp borderline where you can go from one to the other. The existence of a numerator portfolio or numerator deflator or whatever you might call it, and this kind of no arbitrage concept and vice versa. Yes, this is clarified. The same in Martin Gilbert, it's and only F clarified. The equivalents are there. In the particular in the paper is Kadaras. You find it on my web page. So what we need is a consistent framework where pricing and of course hedging and other tasks can be done consistently, and where long-term trends, equity premium, are correctly specified, so that common sense and whatever statistics, historical analysis of historical data and forecast of economic activity, that it all comes together, and under the real-world probability measure, that you don't have any modeling error by just getting into an artificial measure and then this assumption might just trick us in some way. Also, what we know is all benchmark non-negative securities are super martingales, and this is enough to do all this, what I was mentioning. Yes? Not required. The benchmark approach is able to handle long-term trends, in particular the trend which we have that the equity index is having above, say, the savings account. This equity premium in the long term, it will come out. In the short term, we will see it when we go for a continuous or a jump diffusion market. All these benchmark securities will be local martingales. So there is no trend in the short term if you want that. In the long term, these strict local martingales or strict super martingales that might come up in our modeling, which we are allowed to form, which unfortunately risk neutral pricing is not giving us. In the long term, then a trend-like effect comes in, because from this inequality in this strict supermartingale situation, and which you see also in the looks and others. Yeah. So now if we have the freedom to reflect these long-term trends in what we are doing, which risk-neutral is not doing us, one can even say this, just in a nutshell. Risk-neutral pricing is something like relative pricing. You forget about all the trends and drifts, as you know. And then take expectations. So more or less you can consistently price, if there's some price of something, you can go and get another one price which is consistent, and the whole group of traders that act in this market can more or less hedge and trade consistently to each other. This does not mean that the whole group of traders, this market segment, is correctly priced. There may be, and I will show you that, a much cheaper price level which would allow us to achieve these contingent claims that are there. And an example which later, no, I will not have time, but since it comes up, I can just say, think of the subprime, market, which we had experienced and which brought us really to our knees in the financial market in a way. What is a subprime? Also, what is a mortgage? A mortgage is some kind of a contingent claim that is not for 2 or 3 years. No, it's for 25, 30 years. It's a long-dated security. But it was treated by our credit risk theory, as it is in our textbook, as if it is a short-dated thing, and by risk-neutral pricing. It was a relative pricing, not looking really at what economically in the long term could happen. And I show you, and you had already seen that, I showed you more or less a fair zero coupon bond in my example, and say a defaultable bond is with some recovery is very much the same thing. If you fix the recovery to some fixed level and make the default intensity maybe also very fixed, still what you get is in the shape pretty much a zero coupon bond. And the same effect what I showed with my grand-grandmother's savings bond and my grand-grandfather's fair zero coupon bond is coming up in the credit markets. If it is 25, 30 years, that means if you do relative pricing, which has been done, you might end up by prices which are relative to other people's, so the Lehman Brothers prices with the Merrill Lynch prices. They all agreed on this kind of level and they're very happy and were pushing it in the market and cashed in the bonuses and tried to keep it away from their own books. Lehman Brothers didn't understand that part, so they kept it on the books, but Goldman Sachs was getting rid of it very safely in some way, so this made the difference. But the economy was more or less hurt by all of it because someone had to take this gap, which relative pricing could have, bring you, and it could be far away from some, I would call it absolute pricing. And what we will do is here, in the benchmark approach, we will have some form of absolute pricing. We will link it to the real economy via the benchmark, because everything will be linked to this numerator portfolio. How we do this? We know all non-negative securities when benchmarked are super martingales. So there's a very special super martingale. This is the martingale. This is when we have equality. Conditional expectation of a later benchmark value of whatever portfolio we have, could be a contingent claim. And a fair portfolio would be then, or a fair price process would be one where the current benchmark value is the best forecast of the future benchmark values under the real world probability. So economically, what's really going on? So we call this just fair. And this concept is very, very helpful, and we will use it. And then there's a beautiful, simple, very clear and easy effect in stochastic analysis. If you have non-negative super martingales, a family of these, that all run through a later, at some later time, they all run through some random value. Then they're all benchmarked objects, they're all super martingales. Some show you this systematic downward trend, so there may be strict super martingales. And then there is among these many super martingales that may be there, one unique martingale that goes into this random payoff. So the martingale is among all the super martingales more or less giving you the minimal super martingale value that is possible. So this path here, the martingale path into this random payoff, this is special, and that means the minimal non-negative super martingale in this family, what you might have, is the martingale. So this fair price thing, this fair price process, is very special. With the data just for illustration. Later I show you the model which does it, and you can invent your own model. But the principle is this: there's a strict super martingale involved in the, so one can even say the benchmark savings accounts will turn out to be, when it comes to it, will turn out to be a strict super martingale. We will look at it later. And since it is not a martingale, it's just a strict super martingale, you have this kind of effect that there is, here this would be this benchmark savings account more or less, and which gives us this one benchmark dollar, and there is a martingale, so this my grandfather's fair zero coupon bond, where, okay, then I model what I see there, but you see this is roughly the, if you have here identity from your real world economic thinking and modeling, you find maybe that this is identity where it roughly is, yeah, at that time. So, and here the benchmark savings account runs into this, and yes, you need just to get the expectation. So it's clear if the identity sits here, this super martingale property will give you here a really more expensive level than what the expectation under this identity would give you, and it doesn't matter whatever model you will come up, it needs just to have certain properties reasonably correct, and I will give you later a model which is doing it very nicely. No. It gets you 1 unit of a dollar. It's a payoff, yeah? And we calculate it later. So fair is the notion which we will use. So these are the martingales. Fair price processes are the martingales when benchmarked. And this is then the minimal super martingale. Here is a graph, what we were just talking about. This is the benchmark savings bonds. And this was this fair zero coupon bond. Pretty much the graph which I showed you this moment. So this leads us now to what I call the law of the minimal price. You remember we talked about the law of one price, where I said that it's probably a little bit narrow. We saw already, just on this last graph here, that there are at least two self-financing portfolios that lead to the same payoff in our market. So it cannot be that we have the law of one price, because this is not unique, there may be even things in between, but there's a minimal price, so I call it the law of the minimal price. So this is a martingale price, it's a fair price process. So if a fair portfolio replicates a non-negative payoff, then this represents the minimal replicating portfolio. There's no cheaper way of doing it. So it's very important to understand, in your investment universe, where you have a numerate portfolio, the cheapest way of replicating something which you can replicate is by this martingale. And there's no way around it. It is just law of nature. Major transformation, whatever, will not help you. It's just so. Okay. And, yes, and I call it the law of the minimal price. And that is more or less generalizing than the law of one price, because we have to say that we go for the martingale among all these possible super martingales. So it's the least expensive price, yes. It's the least expensive hedge, minimal hedge. And it's economically also the correct price in a competitive market, because assume I am running here an insurance company, and there's another insurance company in Brazil, and they enter all these markets. If I'm going, assume there's a correct price in Brazil and in the market pushing it here into North America. If I'm here feel I can undercut this because I think I'm really strong, it's clear that either on average or when I replicate and try to replicate it, there's no way to do it cheaper. Not on average and also not by replication. So, okay, I will after a while go bankrupt. If I think the other way, I think, look, let these guys do what they want, I follow maybe risk-neutral pricing, which is giving me more expensive things. Well, I put an extra cushion on top. Okay, maybe my advantage here in North America will give me some clients, but after a while, and this is the kind of marketing what is going on and undercutting, I will lose the clients. The business goes to the company from Brazil. Yeah? So that means there's a natural way that the, in a competitive market, the economically correct price will converge to what? Yeah? This is up to you, as you want it. Either I can go on, it's up to you. So who wants a break? Say 10 minutes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, let's have a break. 10 minutes, yeah? Is that good? Thank you. now be given. So is the acoustics fine here, all this? The acoustics, yeah? Good.
Yeah, this is more for the recording.
Okay, good. So let's continue, and don't be disappointed if we don't go through all the slides today and tomorrow. This is not our point. Our point is just an introduction, and this is for me a medium to explain, and I prefer then to discuss with you whatever is interesting. So we go now and look at the contingent claim. What we just need is that its benchmarked value, its expectation is finite. Of course, otherwise it wouldn't make sense, but it's the only thing I really need. And what I'm then looking at, I look at fair price processes. These are then these minimal price processes, as we discussed. And how they come up. The benchmarked value of such a fair price would be the conditional expectation under the information where we are now of these benchmark payoffs. So that's it. It cannot be simpler. So, and here we have now a link to the real economy. I was talking about relative pricing, which is losing this link because the Lehman Brothers people look just at the Merrill Lynch people and the Goldman Sachs, and they can lift the whole derivative market, the subprime market, to whatever level they want, which I think is not good. And you can do that with risk neutral pricing. You just need someone having somewhere a price. You say, this is the market. And the same thing it was with the bankers' trust people. I told them, look, how you handle this. And then they say, we are the market. That's the market. Here's a trade. What do you want? I said, and if it is too expensive, forget it. Here's a trade. There's a client. So what is it? This is the market. We are right. The whole subprime market was right in that sense. But economically, I think it was not right. So here is this Numeraire portfolio, and I indicated, and later we have some more details on it. This is not just some artificial whatever process now. This is a most diversified portfolio from the real existing equity market. So when I concentrate on the equity market in that form, also from the investment universe we have. So this is the economy. It's there. The productive units aggregated in a most diversified way. Sure. So many nice other things we have. Also, mathematically, it's most beautiful what we can take. The supermarket property is such a clean and clear property, which already in stochastic analysis was fascinating many for quite some time. We get the cleanest and also long-term results. One thing which for the financial mathematicians here among us, of course, we have problems even with risk neutral pricing to think on at infinity what is going on there. There is no equivalence of the measures anymore. First, we have no measure change, and at infinity, supermarketing cases behave very nicely. There is no problem. Yeah. Here is the link with the real economy. This is real. This is more or less, you can think, the aggregate of our financial market, its best performing portfolio. And this is a real world condition expectation, not some artificial measure under some model which we don't know. And where there is a question, and I raise this question later, I don't believe that there exists an equivalent risk neutral measure for what we are modeling. Even only in a very short term extraction. So now let's take the law of the minimal price. As I said, there is this martingale among these super martingales. And immediately you can say, the minimum price for a replicable claim is the fair price. Take it. Take what I had on the last slide where it was benchmarked, but now I like to see the pricing formula in domestic currency because this is what we are used to. So here's my benchmark payoff. I need to take the conditional expectation. And if I have nothing here, this should have been the benchmarked value of this price at time t, but I multiply both sides with the value of the Numeraire portfolio, of the gross optimal portfolio at the time t, and then I get the value in domestic currency, and this is then here this fair price in units of domestic currency. So this is a pricing rule. This comes up, I have almost nothing required, I need only one thing, the existence of the Numeraire portfolio. If it doesn't exist, its candidate will explode, so it doesn't make sense. And I need the finiteness of this expectation. And if this is infinite, it also doesn't make sense. You cannot be much more general in a pricing rule than what I have here. This is another issue. We come to it. Now we come to that, yeah? You're right, it's fine. I was talking about replicable at the moment to get this correct, but already this was interesting because we might have several replicating strategies, and there's some phenomenon which you don't cover in the relative pricing world, which we are used to do. We are here. We come to that. Absolute. Sure. Now, but okay, you asked that. What is in the incomplete market? We can use the same pricing rule. And then what is coming up is, this is again very natural. So for instance, I could do utility interval pricing in the sense of Mark Davis and so that, and the same pricing rule comes out in that incomplete market. That would be one way, but I'm not going this. Just a comment. Another way is, you take this pricing rule and ask what kind of concept would match it very nice. Some of you may know local risk minimization, what Martin Schweitzer and Firma did, and I also worked with Martin in the 90s on that, and we wrote papers with David Heath on local risk minimization. And so what comes out? A generalization or a slight rewriting of local risk minimization to what I would call benchmark local risk minimization. Just do it from here. Have as reference unit not the savings account, have as reference unit the numerair portfolio, and have as pricing measure the real world pricing measure. This is local risk minimization. So that's it. What it does, it gives you the minimal price for the hedgeable parts and the smallest variance for the unhedgeable part, and the unhedgeable part is untouched. And in benchmark terms, and okay, to end it here, this discussion, it goes in this way. If you have then many such claims, where the hedgeable parts are all hedged, and then there are the remainders, the unhedgeable benchmarked unhedgeable parts, all these benchmarked unhedgeable parts have mean zero, and the smallest possible variance. So if there are many, you add them all up, these, say, independent benchmarked hedge errors, if you want, mean zero, many will allow you to think along the laws of large numbers. So what will come up? The hedge error in such a large book of an investment bank or insurance company, in principle, for them in that book, it will become almost complete because the law of large numbers will make this benchmark total hedge error vanishing. Yeah? Then it would not, you need to diversify, sure. But this is also very much what everyone knows and clear, yeah? But the law of large numbers. So along the lines, I just become later to that to answer your question here so that you see already where it's going. And very naturally, this pricing rule is the rule. And again, as we discussed here, another issue already, even in incomplete market, economically, this will be the correct price. The hedge errors can be completely diversified out, more or less to zero, and it's a minimal for the hedgeable parts. Okay, so the real-world pricing formula, real-world because it's a real-world probability which is used. But this pricing formula is covering more or less several pricing formulas we know very well. But here's the question. This is another thing. If you like to put it now into an economic context with supply and demand and all this, this supply and demand, whatever you do there, will give you some dynamics, these feedbacks, etc., for your underlying security, for your primary security accounts. Okay? Then you will have for these dynamics a numerair portfolio. Then you benchmark all the primary security accounts, and then you have a contingent claim. And then you do this. And that's the fair price. And that's what you need to do, because if you overprice, your company will lose clients. If you underprice, you can't make it. This is the sequence of, yeah? So fine, there's no problem with having supply and demand driving our prices. So we have many pricing rules, and most pricing concepts we know are in principle fitting into this here, and we can create the links and can interpret what is going on. So for instance, there's actuarial pricing, which I show you in the next slide. Risk neutral pricing I will explain also later. And whether you use discount factors or you can do numeric change deflators, state price densities, pricing kernels, or what we actually do, use a numeric portfolio. This all fits under this real world pricing. Just a question to understand what we are doing there, but these are special cases. So one important special case is actuarial pricing. We know actuarial sciences insurance for, in principle, for centuries has been using more or less net present value type thinking, and that is just what guides successfully a lot. But I have not seen so far a real proof for that. It's just a nice concept as it starts from a principle, more or less. Here we can get, in principle, a proof for it very easily. Think of a contingent claim H, which is independent of the numeric portfolio. So, numeric portfolio, very well diversified index of our investment universe, so like a market index. And you have a contingent claim which is independent of it. Could be my death. Okay? I hope it's independent because I will not jump out of the window if the market crashes again or things like that. Good. Then I have to take the real world pricing formula and take the expectation, say, of my death event benchmarked. So this is independent from this. So I take the, that means I can split the expectation into expectation of H times expectation of 1 over S delta star because of the independence. So when I have, when I do this, I will find that the expectation of this contingent claim and expectation of 1 over S delta star times the numeric portfolio. But this is the pricing, the real world pricing formula for the fair zero coupon bond. It gives me this $1. Okay, that's it. So that means in front of the real world expectation on my best event, there is a discount factor, there's a discounting. This is just net present value. But you take, of course, a zero coupon bond here, and there are issues. We will see later, even if you make deterministic interest rate assumptions, this may mean that it's not just here this savings account type thing. It can be, as you saw, the fair zero coupon bond is a special thing you have really to calculate in our market. But in general, that's the rule, and this is the actuarial pricing rule. Yes. Let's see. There are not too many zero coupon bonds you can go around. If it is just a rollover bank accounting, yes, you have that kind of thing. Yeah. So, okay. That's there are issues. There are issues with reality, and you see it even more dramatically in with variable annuities and insurance. This is the topic of my talk tomorrow afternoon, and this is also the reason why I had been asked by the largest reinsurer, Munich Re, to bring this whole concept very close to them, and they have a large group established now, and they push it probably in the next years in the market, and then it will be the economically correct price, what we are talking about, and there will be a change. So our calculations show clearly there is severe overpricing. Okay, I don't know whether Munich Re will take the difference and let the others come slowly into it. It's not my issue, but the facts are there. Huh? So, also, this is just a simple fact, and you see here a proof for the ancient actuarial pricing rule. And no assumptions almost, no models so far. Supermarketing a property, that's all, and independence. So you have a proof for that. Okay, let's look at other. Let's go towards risk neutral pricing. How does it fit into here? How we can recover this in some way? So we take the real world pricing formula and rewrite it in such a way that we introduce here a prefactor. So here's a contingent claim. And in the real world pricing formula, I had more or less the numerator portfolio times small t over the numerator portfolio times capital T. So I can multiply, as zero is my savings account. I can multiply the savings account at the beginning over the savings account at maturity. When I do that, I get here some extra terms, which is more or less benchmark savings account at time, here capital T, over benchmark savings account at initial time. So pretty much it's benchmark savings account that appears here at this place. So, being now the benchmark savings account is a supermartingale in our environment. In any case, no doubt about that. So we know this. That means this is normalized to 1 at time 0. That means at the beginning, this process here, the supermartingale has a value 1, and this is greater or equal than the expected future value of this normalized benchmark savings account. Now I can use my real world pricing formula and just go and have, instead of this here, dividing the right hand side by this, what is smaller than 1. Yeah, here was divided by 1, I divided by something smaller than 1. So I lift the right-hand side by this operation up, so I get an equality here. It's still all valid all the time for everything. But what you see here is, I have the real-world price, the fair price, and on the right-hand side, this expression, where here is the benchmark savings account. Look, think of benchmark savings account being the radon-nicotine derivative. And for a complete market, the benchmark savings account, also savings account over numerator portfolio, is the radon-nicotine derivative in general. So what you have here is more or less the real-world expectations with here radon-nicotine derivatives. So in principle, if you would have equivalent risk-neutral probability measure, then this would be just the risk-neutral pricing formula, because you can just rewrite it as expectation under risk-neutral of this payoff thing. You would just do the measure change. But I'm not doing it. I just interpret it with you. Because if this would be a martingale, then I can do it and I would have equality, and then my real-world price would be exactly the risk-neutral price. You could go, also maybe the next slide will just do this. And now, what you hear is coming. Here it is. I just assume that this lambda forms really a true martingale in my mathematical model, what I wrote down. Then we have an equivalent risk-neutral probability measure Q. And this formula, what I showed you, which was inequality becomes inequality, and I can what was on the right hand side write under this equivalent risk-neutral probability measure in that form, and it's just again the real-world pricing formula. So you get exactly the thing which you are used to get under risk-neutral pricing. So we derive it. However, in general, going back now, we know only when you do this with some object which is here, super martingale, that your price, when you formally pretend or formally just apply a pricing formula which comes from risk-neutral pricing, without proving that really the radon-nicotine derivative is a true martingale, then you get an inequality of what you get here. And this explains why, for instance, this price for my grandmother is is greater than that's an example of such a situation. So you have then here, because of the strict supermarketing property of this, such inequalities. And this is for many other numerators possible. Take, just maybe it was US dollar savings account here in my example, but you can have other countries' savings account, you can have any other thing which was traded and there was a strict super martingale, and then such inequality could come up. Yeah. So the numerator change. So here now, let's come back to reality. This is the discounted S&P 500. I indicated a diversified portfolio like the S&P 500 gives us a proxy for the numerator portfolio in the market. Let's look at it. So the discounted S&P 500 over these years from 1920 until almost now, this had this kind of growth behavior. And what we would need if we would like to build a complete market model where the S&P 500 is a numerator portfolio and the US dollar savings account then the deterministic and savings account, then the benchmarked savings account normalized to one at the beginning would be the, in this complete market, would be the radon-nicotine derivative. It's just a matter of fact. So here is the radon-nicotine derivative in such a case. The key assumption of risk-neutral pricing is the radon-nicotine derivative has to be a martingale. Otherwise, you can't do what I just did when I switched over to the risk-neutral pricing formula. It has to be a martingale. So it's now your judgment. It's your pension or your life insurance. Whether this is a martingale, it's a good model, or it's maybe just a strict super martingale, this pass. So it's your judgment. If it would be a martingale, I would expect the fluctuations to go on in whatever form, but here it's pretty much so that the probability mass where the savings account divided by the S&P 500 after many years will sit, this probability sits pretty low here, the probability mass. And if it is so, the expectation of this future value is much lower than simply one. So economically, I would think any realistic modeling of reality over long term has to come to the conclusion, say for complete market models, that in principle we cannot justify the assumption that the radon-nicotine derivative of our real market is a true martingale. It's a very heroic assumption. In the short term, it may not matter. Like so, 1, 2, 3, 5 years. It does not matter much. But in the long term, it matters a lot. And it makes a big difference. So that's pretty much the fact, it's reality. This is also what I saw in the mid-90s, in which then sparked the whole research on the benchmark approach. So, for a model which I explain later, a minimal market model, I can calculate the expected value of the benchmark savings account, which is then the expectation in the radon-nicotine derivative, or you could say this is more or less than the risk-neutral mass of the mass of the total risk-neutral measure, which is not a probability measure in such a case. And this will be this graph here. So at the beginning, the total risk-neutral mass, I don't use the word probability because it doesn't add up to one. There's something missing. So this total risk-neutral mass is one at the beginning. It stays very, very flat, so at one for quite some time, several years. And then, if you add up this risk-neutral measure, not probability measure, its total mass is only so much. That means after a couple of years, you have only 50%. And if you then price maybe a put on your pension or on the index, then you are wrong, clearly wrong. Yeah? And what you get will be more expensive than what it should be, because this kind of inequality kicks in. Then you do formally hear something, say, this is my price, I can hedge. You may be also even perfectly hedging it, but there's a cheaper way of doing it, and your competitors will take it from here. Yes? You should please speak louder. I don't.